What I want to do in this talk is maybe talk about modeling at a bit different level than the other speakers. So rather than defining the overall field of computational neuroscience, I'm going to focus on a specific maybe subfield, which is computational cognitive neuroscience. I'm interested generally in learning and memory and how these things take place in different brain structures. A lot of my work has focused on the hippocampus as a particularly specialized region of the brain for certain kinds of memory. But what I'm going to do is actually focus on a specific and very recent piece of research to try to illustrate where I think that the field should be going. And so I'll describe some work I've been doing with Jeff Hinton in the last year on modeling the hippocampus and how it interacts with cortex using Boltzmann machines as a model. So through describing this case study, I want to try to illustrate a general point, which is that there are many different levels at which you can model the brain, and there are different approaches you can take. And so I think the other speakers have illustrated really nicely the benefit of a tight interplay between data collection and modeling. In some cases, modeling very much sort of detailed neuronal properties. And I'm a firm believer in that, and in other aspects of my work, I actually do some empirical work. But in this particular project, I want to illustrate a little bit different point, which is the benefit of having a large-scale computational theory of what's going on in the brain and doing sort of theory-driven work and at the same time trying to make close contact with empirical data. So it's not clear with this approach that it's going to lead to immediate experimental predictions, although that is, of course, the ultimate goal, that you could eventually verify such a model. All right, so and before I dive in, let me just say something about this image. A good friend and colleague, Tracy Shores, was involved in designing a hippocampal garden as part of this larger project called Cork Park at Princeton. It's a wonderful thing. You should look at the website. Just do a Google on Cork Park. And they had a collaboration amongst artists and scientists, and she was asked to design a garden in the shape of a hippocampus. So the bamboo walls were actually laid out in this curvy shape, and this is an image from the garden with this head and branches evocative of the dendritic processes and the continual growth of the brain. So I love this image. Okay, just an aside. Right. So, and then what I'll do is, I guess my talk is meant to hit on one main point in terms of the workshop goals, which is where I see the future directions of the field. But then I'm going to come back to a more general discussion in my last slide about some of the other questions raised by the sort of outline of this workshop. Right. So, how can we understand what the hippocampus does? And one of the kind of traditional approaches is to look at it as a separate brain system and ask what computations does it perform, what kind of memory functions is it responsible for. And with perhaps good reason, there's evidence that if you have damage to this part of the brain, which is sort of buried in the temporal lobe, not part of neocortex, but an older part of cortex, the hippocampus, that you have kind of selective memory deficits. So people with a hippocampal lesion would have difficulty remembering a person that they just met a few minutes ago, or where they'd met someone, or what they had for breakfast, or where they parked their car this morning. So those are sort of things we call episodic memories. So you seem to have a selective deficit for episodic memory when you have damage to the hippocampus and surrounding medial temporal lobe structures. So that sort of comes in two flavors. There's a deficit in the ability to encode new episodic memories, so that's termed anterograde amnesia, and you typically see a loss of memory for events prior to the brain injury, retrograde amnesia. Now, this retrograde amnesia can have a fairly sharp temporal gradient, so you lose memories maybe for a month or two prior to the damage, or it can have a very flat gradient, so with more extensive brain damage. There are cases of patients who seem to have lost their entire lifetime store of episodic memories. But what's interesting is what's preserved in these people with hippocampal medial temporal lobe lesions. So many aspects of memory are intact. For instance, your language, your semantic memory, perceptual and motor functions. So you can learn, for example, by practicing to copy handwriting that's projected, reversed by mirror writing. And a person with hippocampal amnesia can do this task and practice and come back the next day and be asked to do the same task and will say, no, I've never done this before, but they'll show through their motor performance and perceptual performance there was learning and there was memory. So they can do the task better on successive days, even though they deny knowledge of having performed the task before. So many aspects of learning and memory are preserved, but there seems to be a selective deficit in episodic memory. So that really makes it seem as though the hippocampus is doing something special, different from the rest of the brain. Maybe neocortex is doing something more like gradual learning of the general structure of the world, and the hippocampus is learning very specific events. And that view has been very pervasive in the field. There was a very influential paper published in Psychological Review by McClellan, McNaughton, and O'Reilly, which sort of really nicely articulated this view of two memory systems. And furthermore, there's this very pervasive view of consolidation as a process where information is stored quickly in the hippocampus and then gradually gets transferred into neocortex, maybe by a process of replay of memories. So maybe that the hippocampus stores quickly, it's a temporary store, and then it rebroadcasts these memories to neocortex where they get transferred. So that view is very widely held. And probably started with Marr's computational theory of the hippocampus, but there's a lot of data that seem to support it. But what I want to do is actually advocate a little bit different view of how the hippocampus interacts with neocortex and suggest that it's really one system working together toward a common goal. And the goal is something like encoding the sensory input coming in through a probabilistic model of the data. So if the brain, as a whole brain structure, is trying to model the data that comes in through our senses in a way that allows it to predict future data, that would be useful for many different cognitive functions, from perception to action. So maybe the brain is actually forming this sort of predictive model of the world, and that the hippocampus is part of that one system. It's not really doing something completely separate. Now, why would there be these selective deficits in what I've termed episodic memory if the hippocampus is nothing special, if it's just doing the same thing as the rest of the brain? Well, one reason is that the hippocampus is probably at the very top of this hierarchy of brain regions. So this slide illustrates, particularly focusing on the visual inputs into the hippocampus, the fact that the two major so-called visual streams, the so-called ventral or what stream and dorsal or where or how to stream, converge at the level of entorhinal cortex and into hippocampus. So you've got this convergence of input from multiple levels of cortical processing into a point at which this information can be combined. So it makes sense that this structure, which is at the point of convergence, would be critical for things like encoding an episode that includes where were you and who were you with and what were you doing, all the different aspects of an event that make it unique. So you've got convergence of inputs, and not only from vision, but from every sensory modality, typically high-level association areas converge into the hippocampus, some cortical inputs as well. So anatomically, it's well situated to bind things together. there are other things that make it fairly specialized and ideally suited to rapid encoding of complex events, conjunctions of features. For one thing, it's highly plastic. That's where LTP was first discovered. You give a single high-frequency blast of stimulation, and you get synaptic plasticity that's very long-lasting. I'm going to come back to this in a few moments, but the ideal way to harness the plasticity is to stimulate at so-called theta frequency, relatively low-frequency trains. So it may be that learning is somehow synchronized to this theta oscillation. Another striking feature of the hippocampus that's a little bit different from neocortex is that it seems that these neurons fire at very low frequencies, so what's called sparse coding. And an example of this is the place cell. That's where cells were first discovered in rat hippocampus, but have now been shown also in human hippocampus by Mike Kahana's group, that fire selectively when the animal is in one specific location in an environment. So these neurons are encoding in a very precise way a specific piece of information. The opposite of that would be a distributed code where a great many neurons fire to represent any one stimulus. So it's not quite a grandmother cell encoding where there's one neuron for one stimulus, but it's very sparse. And sparse coding and high plasticity would be ideal for encoding event-unique memories, where you'd like to encode what might be otherwise similar memories in a very distinctive way. So if you can use relatively few neurons to encode an event, then you're likely to get a very distinctive code that's sort of minimally overlapping with the encoding of another event that might be otherwise very similar. Another really fascinating feature of hippocampal encoding is the fact that there's neurogenesis in the dentate gyrus. I'm not going to say all that much about it in this talk, but that's a rather burning interest of mine, and I have modeled the effects of neurogenesis on neural coding, and there's a lot to be said about it. But it seems that the new neurons that are generated in the dentate gyrus are the most plastic in that region and easily activated and probably more readily recruited into encoding new memories. So there's another interesting specialization of the hippocampus that seems to make it very well suited for rapid encoding of unique information. And then there's an interesting story emerging about the interplay between the hippocampal system and the neocortex, and that they really are tightly coupled. Here's a schematic that's sort of my view of the different subregions of the hippocampus and how they might operate in different dynamical modes of behavior. So entorhinal cortex sends input in through this hippocampal circuit, the so-called trisynaptic loop. Through the dentate gyrus, CA3 and CA1, information could potentially flow through the circuit and back out again. However, it seems that information is able to be regenerated from the CA3 region and use what I've shown as the pink connections to replay information back out to cortex during the so-called sharp wave events that I'll show in the next slide. So it may be that the hippocampus can sort of operate in these two distinct modes, one that's more data-driven, where sensory input may be coming in through all these levels of neocortex and activating a representation in hippocampus that would be good for encoding. But then at other times, the hippocampus seems to be able to generate activity from probably the CA3 region and reactivate down to the level of neocortex. So there seem to be these sort of two modes of operation that I think are important to try to consider when we try to piece together what is the hippocampus doing and how is it interacting with neocortex. Now, during The two main modes of operation could be characterized by these different frequencies of neural firing. So the hippocampus likes to fire in synchrony with the so-called theta rhythm. So septal inputs into the hippocampus drive it at this sort of low frequency oscillation around 8 hertz or so. And so pyramidal cells will fire in bursts, but in synchrony with the theta rhythm. And there are behavioral correlates of this theta rhythm. So in the rat, for instance, when the rat's actively engaged in perceptual sampling or learning related activities, for instance, when it's running around a maze, when it's sniffing an odor, sampling a cue, you'll see the hippocampus activating in theta frequency. Kahana's group has also observed this in the human hippocampus. When a person's navigating a maze in virtual reality, you'll see theta frequency oscillations in the hippocampus. And it turns out that, as I mentioned already, that the theta frequency firing mode, it seems to be optimal for plasticity. It makes sense that when the animal is actively engaged in sampling the world, when it's in a very sensory-driven mode, that there would be learning taking place. You'd be encoding this information. On the other hand, when the animal, the rat for instance, is engaged in non-attentive behaviors, which might be grooming or feeding or, you know, just sitting there after having just run through a maze, you'll see the hippocampus exhibit this very other kind of dynamical behavior. So these sharp wave bursts, these very high frequency bursts that have been probably most extensively characterized by Buzaki's lab, and superimposed on that, the pyramidal cells will fire in these very high frequency ripples. So these sharp wave ripple events occur during quiet periods as well as during certain stages of sleep. And it seems that the sharp wave events are triggered in the CA3 region and then propagate out to the deep layers of entorhinal cortex, which project back out to neocortex. So what are the implications of all of this for hippocampal coding? Well, one interesting thing that's been observed during these sharp wave events and during slow wave sleep is so-called sequence replay. So I mentioned place cells already. A cell would be called a place cell if it's selectively tuned to a particular location and space. And McNaughton and Wilson are particularly the key contributors in this area of studying sequence replay. The idea is that when a rat goes through a maze, some sequence of place cells will fire, and you can sort of sort them out according to, as the rat moves along the x-axis shown on the top, which cells fire in which locations. And interestingly, if you record those same cells during slow wave sleep, you'll see that the same sequence of cells will fire. So it's really not just random firing that's going on. It seems that it's almost as if the rat is dreaming of that sequence of places that it visited during the earlier maze traversals, or somehow replaying it. And you get sequence replay in a number of different situations. So during these, first of all, just within a single theta cycle, you get some degree of what's called phase precession, so that cells will fire at progressively earlier points within the theta phase, maybe signaling where the rat is about to go to. During slow wave sleep, as I already mentioned, you get these brief bursts of sequence replay. And let me just flip back to the previous slide to mention that the timescales are very different here. So when the rat's really moving through the maze, we've got a timescale of about 5 seconds. During the sharp wave events, when this little sequence is, quote, replayed, it's actually replayed in speeded up time. So the timescale is more like 200 milliseconds. So something's happening. The sequence is being replayed out, but at a very much faster timescale, which makes sense because it's not being sensory driven. But then also during REM sleep, you can see sequence replay lasting up to 2 minutes, and it seems to be more in real time. So there are different kinds of replay going on. And then finally, reverse sequence replay has been observed during these sharp wave events. For instance, when a rat has just finished running through a maze and now is just sitting there, you can see sometimes reverse sequence replay of the place cells in the opposite order in which the rat traversed. So what on earth is that serving? So I'd like to describe a model that actually tries to make sense out of a lot of these data and that proposes a global sort of principle by which the hippocampus and the neocortex might be jointly encoding information, and in which these different kinds of sequence replay actually do make sense. So how could we model this whole thing as one system? Does this make any sense to do this at all? Well, what I want to do now is dive a little bit into the details of the Boltzmann machine. Probably most of you are not familiar with this kind of model. Maybe some of you are. When I was a PhD student, I actually did my PhD work with Jeff Hinton, and he was one of the original inventors of this kind of model. It's sort of an offshoot of the hot field network that maybe some more of you might be familiar with. It's an interesting model, and actually my PhD work was about sensory coding using information theoretic models of sensory coding, but one of the chapters in my thesis involved using Boltzmann machines, just to trying them out to see if that would be a good alternative model. And at that time, I thought, well, these are interesting models, but they have a lot of problems. And I sort of gave up on the Boltzmann machine as being completely hopeless and left it for about 15 years. So it's interesting that I've gone back to it, and I'll sort of walk you through why that is. And I now actually believe that the current Boltzmann machine model that I'll describe to you is probably the most promising contender for a model of learning in cortex and maybe also in hippocampus. And it's really powerful and efficient as well. And you could call it sort of biologically plausible. I'm always cautious about using that term. It's very overused. But it may be the answer to a lot of the questions of how does the cortex encode information with multiple brain regions interacting together, multiple levels of processing, feedback between layers, feedback all over the place. How on earth does this entire circuit work together? So the Boltzmann machine is based on the idea that you can capture the probability that the network is in any given state, where a state is defined by the states of each of the neurons in the network. So any neuron might be firing. Typically, we just characterize a neuron as being in an on state or an off state, so it's firing or not. And so a global configuration would just be whether every neuron in the network is firing or not. And you can capture the probability that the network is in that state by talking about its energy, the energy of that state, which is defined by this equation involving the states of the individual neurons. So I've labeled them as visible and hidden neurons. Visible just means that that group of neurons receives direct sensory input, so there's some data coming in that defines its state. Hidden neurons don't have direct access to data, so they could adopt any state. And we've got connections between the neurons, as in any neural network model, with synaptic strengths represented by these weights, these W's. So we can define this big complicated function which basically characterizes the energy of a state of the model, and we can try to get efficient coding in this model by presenting the network with a bunch of data and trying to create high probability states out of those data-driven states relative to all the other possible states. So if you show the network an image of a face and you want it to remember that face, you would like that the probability that of these visible units having the state associated with that face as input, plus whatever state the hidden units adopt here, that state would have high probability relative to something random or relative to all the other possible states of the network. So that's the basic intuition behind this probabilistic function. And so this innocuous little term in the denominator, this Z term, actually is a summary of all the probabilities of every possible state, which is completely intractable. Questions?
It's a short question to get an intuition. What would be a state with a high and what would be a state with a low energy?
Well, what makes a low energy state is if two neurons have a connection between them, and say it's got a positive weight attached to it. What would make for a low energy state would be if the two neurons are either both firing together or they're both off. So they're in good agreement. There's no tension between them. On the other hand, if there's an inhibitory connection or a negative weight between two neurons and they're both on, they're going to contribute to high energy. There's some tension. Both these neurons are active, and yet they're both trying to inhibit each other. That will contribute to a high energy state, which is bad in terms of this. So the model tries to find configurations where there's sort of good agreement or consensus amongst all the neurons, given the kind of synaptic weights that are currently set. Does that make sense? Okay, so that's the intuition. I'll probably have to speed up a bit. But if you work through the math, and I won't go through any more of the mathematical details, it turns out that the way to create low energy states out of the data-driven activation patterns relative to everything else is to do this sort of two-phase learning, where first you drive the model with some data and you apply Hebbian learning during this data-driven phase, and then you allow the model to just do some dreaming or generate its own fantasies of states, and you have a phase where you have negative Hebbian learning. So this sort of dual-phase learning model gives you just the right thing, but there are a lot of serious problems with it, particularly that to characterize what is the model doing when it's just generating fantasies? You have to actually run it for a long time and actually sample this whole distribution of states. So here's a summary in a textbook on connectionist modeling. Unfortunately, it remains true that the Boltzmann procedures constitute the most torturous account of learning that's ever been advanced. It is therefore perhaps not surprising that no real contact has been established between psychological theory and this form of new connectionism. So these class of models were kind of written off at the beginning as being completely hopeless, which was sort of my summary as I told you about when I was doing my PhD work. However, there have been some recent advances from Jeff Hinton's group that make these models really tractable, viable candidates of learning. I'm going to have to speed up quite a bit. But the essence of the innovations chiefly are using this restricted architecture, not allowing connectivity within layers, only allowing connections between the visible and hidden units. And let me just simplify this down. And the second one is, I'll just take you through this one slide. The idea that you present data to the model and you can more efficiently get the right statistics for the learning, but you don't need to actually sample all the way out to settling to equilibrium. You can take a shortcut. You can take data, activate the hidden states, and then just sort of go one step away and briefly ask what does the model think that it's looking at, allow it to generate some data, and again apply this contrastive Hebbian learning rule, and you get still what are Hebbian learning equations. I'm going to skip all the math, but you don't need to do this sort of prolonged settling procedure. So what's missing, though, from these hippocampal models is a way of applying this in multiple layers, somehow dealing with time. After all, I told you that the hippocampus seems to be important for sequence coding, so there needs to be some temporal aspect to the learning. And then I've shown you a bit of the hippocampal circuitry, that it's rather complicated, so how could this kind of model fit with hippocampal neocortical interactions. And one thing that Hinton's group has found is that when you train a multi-layer sort of set of Boltzmann machine models as a set of these restricted Boltzmann machines, it's very helpful to have what's called an auto-associator at the top level that is able to encode conjunctions of features. And then when you're in this sort of generative mode of replaying states, the model is much more efficient at learning features through the layers of the network. How to deal with time? Well, one simple idea is to just preserve some context in the hidden layer. So you could have connections in the hidden layer that allow you to keep track of a bit of history. And you could even have bidirectional connections so that you can predict backwards in time as well as forwards in time. So that's basically what we've done in trying to model the hippocampus as a circuit with these Boltzmann-type models is we've assumed that jointly the dentate gyrus and CA3 with recurrent connections are able to act like something like an auto-associator to associate complex patterns together, and that the recurrent connections in CA3 allow associations across time. Okay, so that's sort of the simplified model, and I'll just quickly show you some data that the model generates. So I can't really go into the details of this in the short time that I have left, but the model was trained on a sort of spatial learning problem where it's given experience being at every location in a number of different environments, a linear track, this sort of W-shaped maze, and an open field. And the inputs to the model basically represent the locations of boundaries around it. So potentially the model could learn conjunctions of locations of walls to the north, south, east, and west, and form place cell representations. And this is sort of based on earlier modeling work that we've done. And once the model is trained up, what happens is that you can then run the model forward in time for prolonged periods of time, and it can reconstruct the boundaries where it was located. So in this case, it's reconstructing having traversed along the points along a linear track. And interestingly, the learning actually requires that the model reconstruct backwards in time as well in order to get the statistics for the learning. Are we out of time getting there, right? I'm nearly done, actually. So the model actually proposes a computational role for both the forward and backward in time connections that requires both forward and reverse sequence replay in order to collect the statistics for the learning. And we're sort of postulating a different role for hippocampal cortical interactions here. We're not suggesting that the hippocampus codes quickly and transfers information into neocortex, but rather that the two are working together. The hippocampus may have higher plasticity and have this specialized circuitry that allows it to form complex associations and linkages across time, but it needs the neocortex in order to represent the lower level features, and it needs to be able to replay sequences in order to regenerate the conjunction of features that initially drove the model in the data-driven mode. So because of this two-phase learning process, you need data driving the model, and you need to be able to encode it. But how do you know you've got a good model of the data? According to this Boltzmann machine model, you need to be able to generate data as well, reconstruct data, and do the right statistics so that those two aspects of the model, the bottom-up and top-down model, are in register. So you can recognize data, and how do you know you can recognize it? Well, you can also generate that same data. So I think that's a very powerful idea for modeling neocortical learning and also for modeling hippocampal cortical interactions. And I guess I'll skip the future directions and just say something very briefly about, you know, what kind of training do you need to do this specific kind of work? Well, clearly, like the other speakers have mentioned, it helps to have a quantitative background. My own background is a combination of psychology and computer science. I did an undergrad in psychology with a lot of computer science and math courses along the way, and my graduate training was in computer science. Now I'm back in the psychology department. I do work closely with experimentalists, and I do some empirical testing of memory in my own lab. With the neurogenesis work, I work much more closely with physiologist Martin Wojcicki, and we do some testing as well for memory deficits in people with depression. We know that stress influences neurogenesis. In this case, clearly the work has a strong mathematical footing, and it helps to have really strong computer programming skills to be able to develop these models. We're not using packages here that you take off the shelf that simulate, integrate and fire neurons, but we're building novel models with you know, sort of cutting edge learning algorithms. So you need programming skills as well as math skills, and ideally some neuroscience and psychology as well. But what one person has all of that? Typically no one does. So it makes more sense to work in a very multidisciplinary environment where you can work closely with people that have complementary expertise. So some people doing modeling, some people doing data collection, and who are experts on, say, the neuroscience end of things. So just as a concluding point, I think that one important direction for future work is to try to consider what large-scale brain structures are doing and how they interact together. And there's a lot of interest lately in terms of what are things like theta oscillations doing to bind together or synchronize activity across brain regions. And there are different theories about what that's doing, whether it's, you know, some kind of attentional binding mechanism or what it is. But in this work, we've proposed a specific role, which is a role in learning and replay. Encoding bottom-up versus replay of memories as part of this global process of learning to model the world in a probabilistic manner. Thank you.
We have time for one question while John does the transition.
So I very much like the idea of trying to work in integrated systems, because after all, the brain is working in any given moment of time. At the very end, you mentioned the theta and the input output. At this point, you talked about the reverse process, which is something that empirically is only shown blind time and during waves, in contrast to showing not the reverse sequence, but rather sequential replay. That's been seen across labs many times, and it's also been linked to certain synchronizing oscillations between the neocortex and the hippocampus. So at the very end, you mentioned something about the interplay in theta versus, say, a shock wave, slow wave.
Yeah, so I didn't have a lot of time to elaborate on that, but I think what might be happening in the different phases of the theta cycle is that you've got sort of forward propagation of information and a very brief backward propagation or top-down propagation of information, which might include propagating information backwards in time. So you might have, and interestingly, when you stimulate on phase with the theta cycle, you get LTP. When you stimulate out of phase, you get LTD, which would perfectly map with the learning, the two-phase learning of the Boltzmann machine. You've got positive Hebbian learning in the data-driven mode, and you've got a fantasy-driven mode where you've got negative Hebbian learning. So that's another really interesting fit with this type of model to the data, and that would predict a very brief bit of reverse sequence replay during the... If the sequence encoding is primarily happening within the hippocampus, then no, you wouldn't necessarily. It could just be happening within the hippocampus. Something similar could happen in the neocortex. I'm not really sure. I don't know of any evidence that that's the case. But certainly within the hippocampus, that's what I'd predict.
Thank you.